Osho Talk. Zen, The Path of Paradox, Volume 1, Number 6.
The first question. How is it that people who are not enlightened can talk with such apparent inside knowledge and so convincingly about the whole business? Precisely because of that, not knowing, they don't hesitate. Not knowing, they have nothing really to say. They can go on spinning. Not knowing, they can use language more perfectly. If you know, then always language is a barrier. Rather than a help, it is a hindrance. When you know, you have to be constantly aware that whatsoever you are saying is not that which you know. There is a great distance between the two. Sometimes that which you say goes directly opposite to that which you know. A blind man can talk very easily about light. There is no problem. He has no experience to put into words. Words are empty. He can go on throwing them. Of course, he can talk only to another blind man. No man with eyes will be deceived. People who are not enlightened can go on talking to people who are not enlightened. Blinds can lead the blind. And of course, they can argue also well. Truth is not arguable. Truth is not provable. There is no way to prove it. There is no way to logically propose it. It is at the most a seduction. You can seduce a person towards truth, but you cannot convince. Truth is very paradoxical, absurd. A man who does not know what truth is more logical. That which disturbs all logic has not happened yet. You can talk more easily about love if you have not loved. If you have loved, then you will find difficulty at each step. How to express it? How to say the unsayable? The experience is ineffable. It is so vast. It cannot be contained in small words. No container can contain it. The man who knows hesitates. Lao Tzu says, everybody seems to be so certain, except me. He says, I hesitate. As a man hesitates, passing an ice-cold river, he stands on the bank, thinks twice, and then to walks very, very carefully. Everybody is walking so confident. Blindness is very confident. Because you cannot see anything. You can go and walk into a wall with tremendous confidence. But a man who has eyes cannot walk with that confidence. He sees things. All great mystics are unconvincing. They have to be, by the very nature of things. You can find 1001 flaws in their statements. They themselves know the flaws are there. It was just a necessary evil to speak for them. They had to speak. They would have avoided if it was possible. When Buddha became enlightened, for 7 days he remained silent. A beautiful story in the Buddhist scriptures. The gods in heaven became very much worried. It rarely happens that a man becomes a Buddha. And even more rarely, when a man becomes not only a Buddha, but is capable of becoming a master. Even more rare. Many people become Buddhas, but very few of them become masters. Others remain silent. They have attained. They fall into deep silence. Now this man, Gautam Siddhartha, has become enlightened and he has all the capacities of becoming one of the greatest masters of the world, and the gods were right. We know what happened. He became one of the greatest masters of the world. In fact, no other master is comparable. More people attain to enlightenment through him than anybody else. And it seems difficult to surpass him. The gods were right. They came down on the earth. They went to Buddha and he was sitting under his Bodhi tree. And they persuaded him and they argued with him that you have to speak. They challenged his compassion. And Buddha said, I have been thinking about it myself, but it seems futile. First, even if I speak, nobody will understand. Second, whatsoever I speak will not be the truth, will not be the 100% truth. It will be untrue in many ways. Because that which I have known cannot be brought, cannot be reduced to a linguistic form. It is formless. I have got the taste of it, but to assert it seems impossible. And even if I try, and even if I succeed, who is going to understand it? They will not understand. I know it perfectly well, they will not understand, because when I was ignorant, if somebody had talked the way I will be talking to them, I myself would not have understood. It will look absurd. It is absurd. So, why bother? I will keep quiet and disappear into the great nothingness. Then the gods thought over, brooded over, and they said to Buddha, but there are few who will understand. There are always few. Very few. But they will understand. Yes, if you speak to 10,000 people, maybe only one. But even for that one, you have to speak. And Buddha said, that one will become enlightened even without my speaking. One who is so alert to understand me will be able sooner or later to reach by himself, so why bother? The gods were at a loss now what to say to this man. They brooded again the whole night. They thought and meditated, and by the morning they came again and they said, you are right, but still you have to speak, because there are few who are just on the verge. If you don't speak, they will not understand. They will not move. If you speak, they will move. You are right, there are few who will move on their own. But just think, out of 1 million people, even if one is standing just on the boundary and will not take the courage without you, why not speak for him? Even if one man becomes enlightened out of your whole life's efforts, it is worth. And Buddha had to concede to the gods, and he spoke. So much reluctant he was, so much resistant he was. Yes, it is difficult to speak when you know. It is very easy to speak when you don't know what you are speaking. And then the brain goes on functioning like a mechanism, like a robot. It is a tape. To relay information is more easy. To relay wisdom is very arduous. That's why the people who are not enlightened can go on talking with such apparent inside knowledge. Because enlightenment is neither outside nor inside. All outside inside division is before enlightenment. When enlightenment happens, there is nothing inside, nothing outside. In fact, when enlightenment happens, there is nothing ignorance and nothing enlightenment. The day you become enlightened, the whole existence becomes enlightened with you. At least your existence, your vision of the existence becomes enlightened. The inside knowledge is again fabrication. All knowledge is fabrication. Man has been satisfying himself by knowledge. There is a hunger, a deep thirst, a great search to know God, to know truth. And it seems to be so difficult to reach. We satisfy ourselves by knowledge. If somebody gives us knowledge, we hold that knowledge, we cherish that knowledge, we keep it inside. That knowledge by and by, down the centuries, has become very intricate, very complex, very esoteric. Enlightenment is very simple, childlike. Knowledge is very complex. Has to be. It is a cunning invention of man. When you listen to an enlightened person, he is stating simple truths. He is stating very simple truths. He is not talking about great philosophies. He is very factual. In fact, he is not talking about anything. He is simply indicating. Says Buddha, Buddhas only show the path. They don't talk about the goal. You have to walk. Walking, one day it happens to you. The day it happens to you, only that day you will be able to know that all knowledge is fabrication out of cunning and clever minds. And all understanding is very simple, childlike, very primitive. The second question. Henry Bergson also proposes a philosophy of intuition. Is not his approach exactly like Zen? Looks exactly like Zen, but is not and cannot be. Bergson is a philosopher, a great philosopher, but has no experience. He talks about intuition. And talks profoundly and goes in its very intricate depth. But all that he talks is through the intellect. Even his talk about intuition is intellectual. You can talk from the head about the heart. Remember that possibility. You can think you are feeling, and it will be just thinking. Man is so subtle and such a deceiver. You can talk from the head about the heart. You can think about feelings. You can be very logical about love. Bergson had a great appeal. He was talking about intuition. He was anti-intellect. But all that he says is intellectual. That intuition is not his experience. Zen insists on existential experience. You will find many things like Zen, but you will never find anything really like Zen. Apparently so. Intrinsically not. On the surface so. Yes, the container may be the same, but the content is absolutely different. William Barrett recalls that a friend of his went to see Martin Heidegger, the great German philosopher. When he went to see him, he saw Martin Heidegger reading one of Suzuki's books. The friend naturally inquired about his interest in Suzuki and Zen, and the philosopher said, "If I understand this man correctly, that's what I have been trying to say in all my writings." But Martin Heidegger is again thinking, philosophizing, theorizing. A great philosopher, just like Bergson. Even more fundamental than Bergson. Very profound in his writings. Depths upon depths open. But far away from any satori or samadhi. Far away from any enlightenment. And sometimes will behave as foolishly as any ordinary human being. When Adolf Hitler became very, very powerful, he became a supporter of Adolf Hitler. A Buddha supporting Adolf Hitler. Impossible. He became a fascist, this Martin Heidegger. Behaved like an ordinary man, with no understanding and no insight. These are the moments when you see. It is very easy to talk about great things, but to show that understanding in your day-to-day life, how wondrous. To carry fuel. How wondrous to draw water. In small things that understanding has to penetrate. Your ordinary life has to become luminous. Your each moment has to become a light unto itself. All that profundity was meaningless, proved futile. Was not really there. He was as much a fanatic German as any other German. The others can be forgiven, but not Martin Heidegger. It was exactly like here it was happening. Indira Gandhi was turning slowly, slowly into a dictator. And Acharya Vinoba Bhave was supporting her. And he was interpreting her dictatorship as a great experiment in discipline. A great age has started, the age of discipline. Now you can interpret dictatorship as discipline very easily. In that moment, Vinoba Bhave showed his insight. There is none. Remember, you have to watch people's being, not what they philosophize. Philosophies don't go anywhere. They are just verbal games in the mind. Carl Gustav Jung was on his deathbed. And he was reading a book by Charles Luck, Chan and Zen Teachings. That was the last book that he read. That was the book he died with. He expressly asked his secretary before his death to write to the author, Charles Luck, and to tell him that Jung was very enthusiastic. And tell him that when I read what Su Yun said, I also felt as if I myself could have said that exactly that. It was just it. But again, just the intellectual understanding. Jung was not a meditator. A great analyst, a great observer of human minds, a great explorer into the myth, into the unconscious, but he was not a meditator at all. In fact, he avoided all kinds of meditation. Deep down, he was afraid of meditation. When he came to India, Maharishi Ramana was alive. And he will not go to see him. Many people told him, you have come to India and you are such a searcher into the depth of human beings. And here is a man whom we call Bhagwan. You go to him. You will miss a Buddha. You go and look into him. Have a little taste of his air. In what light he lives. And you think about Buddha, and you think about Lao Tzu, and you think about Christ. Why not go to Ramana Maharshi? And he avoided. He went to see Taj Mahal. He will not go to see Ramana. My feeling is, if Buddha was alive, he will not go to see even Buddha. Or if Jesus was alive, he will not go. Why? What was the fear? A deep fear. He was afraid of East itself. And he was propounding in the West that the West should not learn Eastern ways, yoga, tantra, Zen, his whole life. He was propounding the West should not learn Eastern ways because the Western mind is totally different. The orientation is different. And the Eastern ideas can disturb the whole Western psyche. He never meditated and he was very much afraid of death. And he was very much afraid of a dead body, not only of death. He wanted to go to Egypt to see ancient mummies. That was a long, long desire. And at least 7 times he booked and 7 times he cancelled. Once, the last time, he even went to the airport and finally came back. Became so afraid of seeing such ancient dead bodies. That reminds him of his own death. That reminds what is going to happen to his body. That creates great anxiety. Now this man can read Zen, can read about Zen, can even be convinced about its truth, can even feel enveloped intellectually, can even say this, that what Suyun said, I also feel that I could have said exactly, this is it. But Suyun's statement, this is it, is an existential statement. And if Carl Gustav Jung says it, it will be a philosophical statement. It will be a blind man talking about light. These are logicians. They are very, very rational people, but not very reasonable. Remember, to be rational does not mean that you are reasonable. A rational person, by the very fact that he is rational, cannot be reasonable. Because to be reasonable means to give some space for irreason also. To be reasonable means to accept the paradox of life. To be reasonable means don't ask only for life, death also is there, accept it. And don't only think of God, devil is also there, accept it. Light is there, so is darkness. Accept both. A reasonable man is a great acceptance, a great receptivity. He does not carry any prejudice in his mind. He does not have any presuppositions in his mind. His mind is open, utterly open. A rational man is not so open. He is clever in logic. Logic is a man-made thing. Logic is manufactured by us. Logic is only half of our brain. The other half remains starved. I am not saying that the other half is meditation. Remember, one half is logic, another half is illogic. When you go beyond both, when you transcend both, there is meditation. Remember, thinking is not meditation, so is feeling, not meditation. Thinking is half, feeling is half. When thinking and feeling disappear into one unity, and now you cannot call it either thinking or feeling, it is not. It has transcended both. It is something more than both. Something new is born. The whole is not the sum total of its parts. Now the whole is born. The parts have disappeared into something new, something absolutely new. Here, in the world of transcendence, 2 plus 2 is 5, not 4. In the ordinary world, 2 plus 2 is 4. In the world of meditation, wholeness, totality, 2 plus 2 is 5. Never 4. Because the whole is more than the sum of its parts. Something new arises. The tick. When you put the clock together, the tick arises. When you take the parts apart, the tick disappears. That tick is the transcendental thing. That tick is life. That tick is meditation. That tick ultimately is God. Logic cannot give you that tick. And logic is a prostitute. Always remember. Logic can go with anybody, whosoever is ready to pay. Logic is sophistry. So you can use the logic. For God, you can use the same logic against God. You can use the logic for meditation and you can use the same logic for against meditation. Logic has no love. Logic has no sincerity. Logic is very insincere. In Greek philosophy, there was a time for hundreds of years, sophists prevailed. They were real logicians. They were pure logicians, liars. They said, we don't say what truth is. You tell us what truth is and we can prove it. Comes your antagonist and he says, this is the truth and I will be paying you more. We can prove that. Listen to this small anecdote. G.K. Chesterton is credited with the story of the wily bandit who was finally captured by the king's troopers. The king, a man fond of games and riddles and a very, very well-known logician, posed this problem to the bandit. You may make one statement. If you tell the truth in it, you will be shot. If you lie, you will be hanged. Now this is what is called dilemma. The king said, if you tell the truth in it, you will be shot. Make one statement, a single statement. If you lie, you will be hanged. And the bandit confounded him because he was also a logician. With this reply, I am going to be hanged. Do you get it? Now if it is true, difficult then. Because the king has said, if you tell the truth in it, you will be shot. If it is true that I am going to be hanged, he has to be shot, but then it becomes untrue. If it is untrue, if it is a lie, the king has said, if you lie, you will be hanged. If you think it is untrue, he has to be hanged, but then it becomes a truth. Logic is such. It is a game. Never depend on logic. Never rely on philosophy. Man's too much reliance on logic and philosophy has destroyed all possibilities of religion. Religion is more than logic, more than philosophy. Zen is pure religion. It is an experience. It is an invitation to fall into existence, to dance with existence. That's what meditation is. For a moment, you disappear. You become part of this great dance. For a moment, you are no more yourself. You become the self of the whole. Yes, in the beginning, it is only for a moment. For a moment the ray enters and the darkness disappears. And you are in the dance, in the same dance as the stars are. And the planets, and the sun, and the moon. In the same dance in which seasons move, and spring comes, and flowers bloom. In the same dance for a single moment you enter. Then by and by, you become more and more aware of the possibility that you can slip into it more and more. Then you become more slippery. Then again and again, more and more you slip into it. Then one day, you start abiding in it. Then you are no more, and for the first time you are. Never be deceived by Bergson, or Martin Heidegger, or Carl Gustav Jung. the third question. Why do we voluntarily repress ourselves and adopt crippling defense mechanisms for the survival? The child is helpless. He cannot survive on his own. This helplessness has been exploited for centuries. We have oppressed children as we have oppressed nobody else. Yes, laborers have been oppressed, but not so much. Yes, women have been oppressed, but not so much as children. Children are the longest oppressed class of people. And it seems very difficult how to make them free of parents. It seems almost impossible. The child is so fragile, he cannot exist on his own. You can exploit this thing. You can force the child to learn anything you want. That's what B.F. Skinner goes on doing in his lab. He teaches pigeons to play ping pong. But the trick is the same. Reward and punishment. If they play, they are rewarded. If they don't play, if they are reluctant, they are punished. If they make a right move, they are rewarded, given food. If they make a wrong move, an electric shock. Even pigeons start learning ping pong. That's what has been always done in the circus. You can go and see. Even lions, beautiful lions, caged. Elephants. Just moving according to the whip of the ringmaster. They are being starved. They are being rewarded, punished and rewarded. The whole trick. What you do in the circus with the animals, you go on doing with your children. But you do it so unconsciously because it has been done to you. That's the only way you know how to train and bring up. That's what you call bringing up. In fact, it is bringing down. It is forcing them into lower existence rather than bringing up to a higher existence. These are all Skinnerian tricks and techniques. That's why voluntarily we start repressing ourselves and adopt crippling defense mechanisms. A child does not know what is right and what is wrong. We teach him. We teach him according to our mind. The same thing may be right in Tibet and may be wrong in India. The same thing may be right in your house and may be wrong in your neighbor's house. But you force on the child, this is right. You have to do it. The child gets approval when he does it. Gets disapproval when he does not do it. When he follows you, you are happy and you pet the child. When he does not follow you, you are angry. And you torture the child. You beat the child. You starve the child. You don't give your love to him. Naturally, the child starts understanding that my survival is at stake. If I listen to this mother and to this father, it's okay. Otherwise, they will kill me. And what the child can do? How he can assert himself against these powerful people? They loom large. They are huge and very big and very powerful. And they can do anything. By the time the child becomes powerful, he is already conditioned. Then the conditioning has gone so deep in him that now there is no need for father and mother to follow him. The inner conditioning, what they call conscience, will go on torturing him. For example, if the child starts playing with his genitals, which is a joy to children, a natural joy. Because the child's body is very sensitive. It is not sexual at all, in the sense you use sexuality. The child is really very, very alive. And naturally, when the child is alive, his genitals are more alive than other parts of the body. That is where life energy accumulates. The most sensitive part. Touching and playing with the genitals, the child feels tremendously happy, but you are afraid. It is your problem. You start being afraid that he is masturbating or something. It is nothing. It is sheer joy of playing with one's own body. It is loving one's own body. It is not masturbation or anything. But your guilt, your fears, and somebody may see that your son is doing this. And what they will think, how you are bringing up your children. Make them civilized, teach them something. You stop. You shout at the child. You say, stop! Again and again and again. And by and by, the conscience arises. Stop, stop, stop. It goes deeper, 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 becomes an unconscious part of the child. Now, no need for you. When he will start playing with his genitals, something from the inside will say, stop! And he will become afraid. Maybe the father is looking or the mother is looking and he will feel guilty. And then we teach him that there is a Godfather who is looking always. Everywhere. Even in the bathroom. He goes on looking everywhere. This concept of God cripples. Then you are not free even in your bathroom. You are nowhere free. That omnipotent God follows you like a detective. Wherever you are making love to a woman and he is standing there. He won't allow you. He is a super policeman. And the conscience that the parents have created. That's why Buddha says, unless you kill your parents, you will never become free. Killing the parents means killing the voice of the parents inside you. Killing the conscience inside you. Dropping these nonsense ideas and starting living your own life according to your own consciousness. Remember, consciousness has to be more and conscience has to be less. By and by, conscience has to disappear completely and pure consciousness has to be lived. Consciousness is the law. Let consciousness be the only law. Then, whatsoever you feel, it is your life. You have to decide. It is nobody else's life and nobody else has any right to decide. I am not saying that you will always be doing right. Sometimes you will do wrong. But that too is part of your freedom and part of your growth. Many times you will go astray. But that is perfectly right. Going astray is a way of coming back home. A person who never goes astray, never comes home. He is already dead. A person who never does anything wrong, never enjoys doing anything right. He is just a slave. A mental slavery is created. And long time a human child is dependent on the parents. At least 21 years or 25 years. It is a long time. One third of his whole life. One third of his whole life is being conditioned. Just think, 25 years of conditioning. Anything can be forced. And once you learn these tricks, it is very difficult to forget them. That's why it is so difficult to take a jump into reality. to become a sannyasin, it is so difficult. Sannyasin just means taking a jump out of the social structure around you, taking a drastic step, because slowly, slowly you cannot get out of it. You take a quantum leap. You risk all. You simply get out of it as if the house is on fire. It is on fire. And you start living your life. Of course, in the beginning it will be very, very sick. You will tremble many times because you will be against the parents. Naturally, you will be against the society. The society is your parents writ large. Your parents were nothing but agents of this society. It is all a conspiracy. The parents, the teachers, the policemen, the magistrates, the president, it is all a conspiracy. They are all together. And they are all holding the future of all children. Once you have learned, then unlearning becomes very difficult because 25 years of constant repetition, you are completely hypnotized. A de-hypnosis is needed. You have to drop all this conditioning. Yes, it is simply survival. The need to survive. The child wants to live, that's why he starts compromising. He bargains. Anybody will bargain. When there is a question of life and death, if you are dying in a desert, and somebody has water, and you are thirsty and you are dying, he can ask any price. He can say, crawl and kiss my feet, and you will crawl and you will kiss his feet. He can manage, he can force anything upon you. That's what we have done up to now with children. I am not saying, go and kill your father and mother. They were victims just as you are victims. They were victims of their society, of their parents. And those parents were again victims in their own turn. It is a long, vicious chain. So I am not saying make your parents feel guilty. Feel compassion for them also because they are in the same boat as you are. In fact, you are in a far better situation. At least you have heard it, that something different is possible. At least a slight opening of the door. At least a little awareness that you can get out of it. Even that was not possible for your parents. Because they went to a church, they went to a temple, they went to the Pope, they went to the Shankaracharya, and you have come to me. That is the difference. If you go to the church is in the service of the society. Jesus was not, remember, Pope is. Jesus was not a church. I am not a church. Buddha was not a church. When Buddha was alive and people went to him, they were fortunate. When Buddhism became a church, it started serving the society. Once religion starts serving the society, once religion becomes an establishment, it is no more religious. It is politics. The church is in the service of the society. The temple, the mosque. Muhammad was not. Neither was the Adi Shankaracharya, the original Shankaracharya. But the Shankaracharya of Puri and others, they are in the service of the society. Just few days before, a doctor wrote a letter to me from Pune. Somehow he persuaded one of the Shankaracharyas. There are four Shankaracharyas for four directions. I don't know whom he persuaded. He persuaded one Shankaracharya to come and to see me. Of course, he must have come very reluctantly. But the doctors must have been powerful. The Shankaracharya must be staying at the doctor's house. Somehow he managed. He brought him on the gate. And while the doctor was talking to Sant, the Shankaracharya saw one sannyasin coming with another sannyasin, a man and a woman holding hands, very lovingly walking by. And he became furious. And he said, "Take me away from here immediately. What is going on? What is this? Is this religion? War is okay. War is religion. Love is not okay. If two persons are killing each other, it is perfectly okay. It may be jihad. It may be a religious war. But if two persons are kissing each other, impossible. This cannot be tolerated." He said, "Immediately take me away from here. I don't want to see this man. Look at his disciples, what they are doing. They will destroy the whole society." Precisely. That's what we are trying to do. We want to destructure it. And I am all for love and all against for war. In the scriptures, war is praised. Love is never praised. Because war is in the service of the society. Love is not in the service of the society. Love is the most dangerous thing. Love is the most rebellious thing. Lovers become antisocial. You can watch it. If two persons are in love, they look into each other. They forget the whole world. They are antisocial. Love in itself is antisocial. They are so much absorbed into each other, they don't bother. They will not go to the polling station to vote. Who bothers? They will not go to listen to the prime minister. They will not even bother to read the newspaper. It is the same crap every day. They will use that time in singing, dancing, loving. Or they may simply sit and look at the stars. Their eyes are full of a totally different kind of quality, a different kind of energy, a different quality of that energy. They are no more here in this world. They are transported. Love has always been dangerous for the society. The society has killed it. In subtle ways, it has destroyed it. It has left man completely loveless. And this loveless man is very easy. He can be forced into anything. You can make a loveless person easily afraid. Watch the mechanism. If you are in love, nobody can make you afraid. Love has a fearlessness to it. But if you are not in love, you are already in fear. Without love, there is only death and nothing else. Only love transcends death. Only love is immortal. Everything else is mortal on this earth. Now that Shankaracharya became very, very angry. That anger shows many things. First, he must be very sexually repressed. Otherwise, why get angry? One man holding the hand of another woman, she is not your woman. Why get angry? What that has to do with you? And what is wrong in it? Sexuality repressed. Must have become afraid inside himself. His own obsession. This young man has touched his obsession. These people are in the service of the establishment. Naturally, the establishment helps them in every way. It is bound. People like me cannot be helped by the establishment. We are not in conspiracy with them. In fact, they allow us alive. That's a miracle. It must be because it is very difficult now to kill a person just like the crucified Jesus, or just like as the poisoned Socrates. Man has grown a little bit. Man's consciousness has become a little more alert. Man is more aware. This is 20th century. But they do all that they can do to hinder, to obstruct. Why do we voluntarily replace ourselves and adopt crippling defense mechanisms? That is not voluntary. It looks like voluntary because the day you become alert, it is almost inside your blood and bones. But it is not voluntary. No child ever learns anything voluntary. It is forced. It is violent. You can see any child. Every child resists. Every child fights to the very end. Every child creates trouble for the parents. Every child tries hard this way and that to escape from this crippling mechanism. But finally, parents get hold of him. They are more powerful. It is simply a question of the powerful and the powerless. And so it is not unnatural that when children are grown up, they start taking revenge with the parents. That reaction is natural. It is very difficult to forgive your parents. That's why all societies teach you to respect them. At least respect them, you cannot forgive them. You cannot love them, at least respect them. But that respect remains formal, bogus. Deep down you remain angry. If what I am saying is hurt, if what I am saying becomes prevalent someday in the world, then children will really love their parents. Then children will really be in tune with their parents. Because parents will not be enemies to them. They will be friends. The fourth question. Can you tell us just in few words what is the most basic secret of Zen? Let go. Life reveals itself most plainly when you do not clutch at it, when you don't cling to it, when you don't hoard, when you are not a miser, when you are loose and ready to lose, when your fist is not closed, when your hand is open. Life reveals itself most plainly when you do not clutch at it, either with your feelings or with your thoughts. Touch and go. That is the secret, the whole secret, the whole art. Everything kept goes stale. Everything, I say. Hold and you kill it. Hold and it stings. The reason is that whatever is momentous, living and moving, is momentary. By hoarding, you want to make it permanent. You love a woman, you love a man, and you want to possess, you want to be permanent. It can be eternal, but it cannot be permanent. Understand it. Try to understand. It is momentary, but if you live the moment in a total let go, it is eternal. A moment lived totally in a relaxed state of mind is eternity. But you don't live in the moment and you don't know what eternity is. So you want to make it permanent. You want it to last for tomorrow also, day after tomorrow also, the coming year and maybe the coming life. You want to hold it. These three words are very important. Momentary, permanent, eternal. In ordinary dictionaries, the meaning of eternal seems to be forever and forever. That is wrong. That is not the meaning of eternal. That is the meaning of permanent. Then permanence becomes eternity. It is not. Eternity is not duration. Eternity is the depth in the moment. Eternity is part of the momentary. It is not against the momentary. Permanent is against the momentary. If you go deep into the moment, you drop into the moment totally and utterly dissolved into it, you have a taste of eternity. Each moment lived totally and relaxedly is eternity lived. Eternity is always present. Now is part of eternity, not part of time. Let go. As a leaf goes with the stream. Basso sings, when the lightning flashes, how admirable he who thinks not, life is fleeting. A tremendous statement. This is the beauty of Zen people. You will not find it anywhere else. This is something unique to Zen. Ordinarily, religious preachers and priests will be talking, life is fleeting. Life is going. Life is sleeping. They create a desire in you to hold. They create a greed in you. And they create a greed for the other worlds. Heaven, paradise, nirvana, or whatsoever it is. This life is fleeting. Before it goes, use this time and hold something in the other world. Some virtue, some punya. Says Basso, when the lightning flashes, how admirable he who thinks not, life is fleeting. And same guy, the morning dawns, the night soon follows, life transient as dew, yet the morning glory, unconcerned, goes on blooming, blooming its short, complete life. Let this sentence sink into you. Its short, complete life. Short but complete. The morning glory is loved very much by the Zen people. And the reason is that it opens in the morning and by the evening it is gone. By the morning it was there, so beautiful, so authentic, so real. And by the evening, the flower has faded, dropped into the earth, ready to disappear. The morning glory is exactly a symbol for life. But when the morning glory blooms, in that small life, in that short span, it is complete. It is total. It lacks nothing. Those few moments are enough. Eternity is touched. You live 70 years, but you don't live. A hoarder never lives. A miser never lives. You ask me, can you tell us just in few words what is the most basic secret of Jain? Let go and touch and go. Dzogchen said to his master, I have experienced the dropping of the body and the mind. Master Nyojo exclaimed, then for what are you waiting now? Drop this too. A slight hesitation on Dzogchen's part. He could not understand. And the master hits him hard on the head. And Dzogchen laughed. He got it. He prostrated himself before his master. And the master says, that's dropping, dropped. That is dropping, dropped. This is utter relaxation. This is utter let go. Even nirvana is dropped. Even God is dropped. Even spirituality is dropped. Even meditation is dropped. Meditation is perfect when meditation is dropped. You have arrived when you have even forgotten about enlightenment. This is total relaxation. This is let go. Just before he passed away, at the age of 60, Basu is set up in the lotus posture and to those gathered around him said, don't be misled. Look directly. What is this? He repeated this very loudly again, and then laughed, relaxed, and collapsed and died. This is utter relaxation he is showing to his disciples. This is let go. Don't be misled. Look directly. The dying master. What is this? They must have become very alert. They were thinking that he is going to die. Suddenly he sits in a lotus posture. Unexpected. They may have been dozing, but now you cannot doze anymore. What he is doing, this old man. And then he shouts real loud 3 times. Look directly. Don't be misled. What is this? Collapses, laughs, relaxes, dies. Dying in such a relaxed way and living in such a relaxed way is what Zen is. The whole secret, the whole art. The 6th question, so it is clear that God does not exist, witches do not exist, what about the enlightened one? Never heard of any. The 6th question, why don't you wake me up right now? Because right now, you are not yourself. If I wake you up, somebody else may be awakened. Listen to this anecdote. A traveling salesman in a big southern city is looking for a hotel in which to spend the night. It is dusk, and he has had a hard day. And every hotel he tries is full. He walks and walks, and finally in desperation tries one down in the slums which has a sign over the door for colored only. The manager refuses him, saying, "Eh, we got a room, but we aren't going to rent to no white hunky bastard." The guy leaves, walks for miles, but can't find a single hotel with a room. So he gets an idea. He buys a tin of black shoe polish, goes into a man's room and applies it liberally to his hands and face. Then he goes back to the hotel and says, "Hey brother, you got any rooms?" The manager gives him the room and he falls into a grateful, exhausted sleep after having told the manager to be sure and wake him promptly at 6, as he has a plane to catch at 7. In the morning there is a rap on the door and the manager sticks his head in, saying, "Get up, It is 7:15. I done forgot to wake you. The guy grabs his suitcase, scrambles into a taxi, curses all the way to the airport, and arrives with 3 minutes to spare. He grabs his boarding pass and heads for the gate, only to be stopped by the stewardess, who cries, "No niggers on this plane." "But I am not a nigger. I am not a nigger," else the man. "Look, I will show you." And he dashes to the men's room and starts frantically scrubbing his hands and face. But the black won't come off. He scrubs and scrubs, and then, looking in the mirror, he suddenly moans, "Ah, my God, they must have woken up the wrong man." So wait a little. Everything in its right moment. Don't be in a hurry and don't be impatient. It has happened many times that a man is accidentally wakened up. Then he goes mad. He is bound to go mad. He will not be able to absorb that much. Sometimes it has happened. There are many people around the world, even at this moment, who are mad because they stumbled upon something which they were not ready to absorb yet. Sufis know about them. In India, they are called mastaz, mad people. Very beautiful people, but very disoriented. The world is gone. The old nightmare is no more, but the dawn has not happened either. The night is over and the morning has not come, and they are just hanging in between, in its kind of limbo. A right season and a right moment, and that the master has to be constantly looking when the right moment comes. Only then, otherwise, your nervous system will not be able to absorb it. It will be too much an explosion. It will throw you into bits. And unless awakening happens into integration, it is meaningless. Just by being awake is not going to help. It has to become an integration too. You should be awake and you should become centered too. If your awakening shatters you and you fall into pieces and you lose your togetherness, that will not be of much help. That will not be of any value. In fact, the old stage was better, because you could have struggled, you could have tried. Now you cannot even try. One of the great masters of this century, Meher Baba, worked for these mad people for many years. He traveled all over India. That was one of the rarest of works any master has ever done, in search of these mad people, because they cannot do anything on their own now. They have lost all reason. They cannot do anything on their own. Their ego is shattered, and the egolessness has not arrived yet. They are simply in a negative state, not knowing who they are, not knowing where they are, not knowing what they are doing. He traveled all over India, from one village to another village, searching for these people. And he found many. And he helped many. Because only a master can help these people. They are completely, utterly helpless. They are like children. You have to feed them. They will be eating there and they will defecate there at the same place. They will lie down there and go to sleep. They don't know what is what. Either they have to be pulled back to the normal so that they can start their journey again, or some master has to go and help them to pull them up. But things become difficult, more complicated. Never be impatient. Trust life. Go in deep trust. Everything is bound to happen whenever the right moment comes. There is no need to hanker for it. The seventh question, I have heard the person one loves does not really exist, but is a projection focused through the lens of the mind onto whatever screen it fits with the least distortion. Can you elaborate? There is no need to elaborate. You heard absolutely rightly. That's how it is. It is a simple fact. We go on projecting. We go on seeing things which we want to see. We never allow reality to be as it is. We never allow that which is to be mirrored in us. We go on carrying thoughts, desires, ideas, and we project them. And in love that happens more. Because in love, you are almost in a psychedelic trip. Love is psychedelic. Some kind of inner LSD is released. Some hormones are released. Some chemical things change inside you. You are affected by those chemical changes. And you start seeing things. You become a visionary, a dreamer. And the person you fall in love with may not have anything to do with it. He may be just a screen. But then you are bound for trouble. A love that happens with such unconsciousness creates misery. That's why there is so much misery in the world. Before really love can happen, one has to become very, very meditative. One has to become so alert that there is no more any cloud in the eyes and you can see persons as they are. But before you can see persons as they are, you will have to see yourself as you are. The first step has to be taken about self-awareness, self-remembering. Only then you will not project. And when the projector stops working, functioning, you see the person as he is, then there is never frustration. Because you already know. You see the person through and through. If you decide to be with him, it is your decision. Knowingly done, deliberately done, consciously taken. You know what is going to happen. All is mirrored in you. And then there is no frustration. Frustration is out of expectation. Expectation is our projection. All kinds of love frustrate unless love is based in meditation. The eighth question, what is not a head trip? All trips are head trips. Trip as such is of the head. The heart goes nowhere. It knows no journey, no pilgrimage. It is simply here now. When all trips dissolve, you reach. Trips take you away, away from the reality that is. So wherever you are going with the help of the head. The head is the horse. Wherever you want to go to Delhi or Washington or to heaven, it does not matter. The head is the horse. It takes you everywhere. It takes you everywhere except that place where you are. If you want to be there where you are, you have to kill this horse. You have to slay this horse. You have to be a murderer of the mind. You have to be without head. Head dropped. Mind no more functioning. Where can you go? You are here now. And that's what God is. Our nirvana is. The ninth question, you love me, but do you like me? This is a really nasty question. I love you, all right. But I cannot like you because I cannot dislike you. Like and dislike are part of a dual mind, part of duality. When one chooses, and when one does not choose. Like and dislike is part of choice. I don't choose. I love you. But I cannot say I like you because I cannot say I dislike anybody. Like and dislike go together. If I have to like somebody, I will have to dislike too. It will be always with a price. The question is from Rakesh. If I love Rakesh, I will have no trouble with anybody else. I can love all. I can love whole of existence. Loving Rakesh is non-competitive. Loving Rakesh, I have not to deny anybody else from my love. Love is so vast. It can contain all. But like is very narrow. If I like Rakesh, then I will have to dislike Big Prem. Because it is difficult to choose the husband and wife both. No, I don't like, I don't dislike. I love you. Certainly I love you. The tenth question, there is no truth, no untruth. What is. A man may agree that a tree is a tree, but what does a dog think? There is no truth, no untruth. What is. This is the truth. What is. That's all what is meant by truth. A man may agree that a tree is a tree, but what does a dog think? A dog thinks a tree is a toilet. And the last question. How to decide when you are joking and when you are serious? Whenever I am serious, know well I am joking. And whenever I am joking, know well I am serious. I joke only because the thing is so serious. That is the only way to say it. Otherwise, it will be too hard. It will hit too hard. And I am not violent. Yes, I can understand your trouble. I confuse you. Abraham Lincoln used to say about himself, he used to play this joke on himself. He was known as the buffoon president in America in his days. Two MS ladies were talking. "Who do you think will win the war?" asked the first. "The South," replied her friend. "Why?" "Because I hear Jefferson Davis is a praying man." "But old Abraham is a praying man too." "Eh, but the Lord will think old Abe is joking." Yes, that is my trouble with God too. Even to God I cannot convince sometimes that I am serious. "So what about you?" "It is natural." But I give you this pointer. Whenever I am joking, you can be certain I must be serious. And whenever I am serious, you can be certain I must be joking. Enough for today.